Inside Personal Growth. This is Greg Voisin, the host of Inside Personal Growth, and I want to thank all my listeners who join us from around the world to listen to the words of wisdom and extract the knowledge from our authors. And in this case, this morning, we have a returning author. He's not only an author, but he's got a CD series out that we're going to be discussing today called Meditations to Change Your Brain, Rewire Your Neural Pathways to Transform Your Life. And Rick Hansen, Dr. Rick Hansen, and Richard Medinas, MD, are the two gentlemen that created this. Good morning to you, Rick. How are you?
Good morning to you, Greg, and I'm feeling great. Very happy to be here.
Well, we appreciate you having you on Inside Personal Growth and speaking with my listeners a little bit about meditations that really can change the brain. We do a lot of programs on meditations, but I want to let our listeners know just a little bit about you. Rick is a returning guest. This is his second time on Inside Personal Growth. He, the last time we did a podcast on his book called Buddha's Brain, The Practice of Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. And it was a great program. And this CD series, it's three CDs, is put out by Sounds True. And for all of my listeners who know, we are working with many of the Sounds True authors now. And Rick happens to be one of them. Rick is a neuropsychologist and the founder of Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. Summa cum laude graduate of UCLA. He teaches at universities and meditation centers in Europe, Australia, and North America. His work's been featured on the BBC and in the Consumer Reports, Health, U.S. News and World Report, and other major magazines. As I just mentioned, his book called Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom is a great program, and it's a great book, and it's also been published into 12 languages. An authority on self-directed neuroplasticity, he edits the Wise Brain Bulletin and has a weekly e-newsletter called Just One Thing, which I'll tell my listeners to go sign up for. Your Wise Brain blog is on Huffington Post, Psychology Today, and other major websites. Well, Rick, it's a pleasure having you back on again. And, you know, one of the things that this CD series talks about is you talk about steadying our mind to tap into the full creative power. Tell our listeners, really, you know, you're working with these neural circuits. How is this meditation assisting in these new things that you find to tap into and kind of rewire these neural circuits?
Great. Well, the takeaway point is that scientists today are now figuring out exactly how it is that your thoughts and feelings, desires, hopes, worries, upsets, strengths, gratitude, and all the rest of that, for better or worse, gradually changes neural structure. In other words, in the famous saying from the Canadian psychologist Donald Tapp, neurons that fire together wire together. In other words, for better or worse, in the traditional saying, you know, the mind takes the shape of what it rests upon. Well, to update that to the 21st century, the brain takes the shape of what the mind rests upon. Therefore, it's really critical to get more and more control of where you rest that mind. In other words, if you think about it, attention is like a combination of spotlight and vacuum cleaner. It illuminates what it rests upon, but then it sucks it into your brain. Because neuroplasticity, in other words, this general process whereby mental activity changes neural structure, neuroplasticity is heightened for what's in the field of focused attention. So if you put your attention, for example, every day a lot on things you're worried about, regret, self-criticism, or that ongoing kind of grumble case that can run in the head, you know, about other people in our lives, right? Well, then gradually that will wire neural circuits of depression, anxiety, irritation, and so forth. On the other hand, if you can control that spotlight, which is not easy to do in the beginning, but if you can control that spotlight and gradually pull it away from the stuff that's not, you know, really helping you, in other words, past the point that's productive. So if you can pull it away, though, and rest it increasingly on good facts, in other words, good qualities in yourself, good events around you, good accomplishments, many of which are mild and modest, but it's the daily little things that build a life, right? If you can gradually do that, then the brain will take the shape over time of optimism, happiness, strength, good-heartedness, and so so forth. And so a beginning set of skills, of course, is to learn how to control that spotlight better. And I'd be happy to mention a few practical suggestions, if you want, Craig, that are based in brain science about how to do that, because we did evolve a kind of monkey mind, you know, that scoots that spotlight in every direction. Plus, we live today in a kind of ADD culture.
Well, I definitely want you to get to those, but I want to ask you a question, because there actually Ode Magazine this month says Optimism 2.0, and I was reading an article this morning, actually. And what I think our listeners might be interested in knowing, Rick, is, you know, you've done all these studies about these neural circuits and redesigning them, or I should say repositioning them. The key thing in Buddhism and meditation, and you're taking Western and Eastern and kind of blending them here, is this awareness. And what I want to have you speak to for a minute before we get into some of those practicalities you were speaking of is just how does one heighten their sense of awareness to redirect their focus of their mind to these positive behavioral outcomes?
That's a profound question, actually. I mean, from a scientific standpoint first, let's be clear. No one knows how consciousness arises. I mean, literally, it's like no one knows what led to the Big Bang, you know? And it's at that same level of question. Scientists still do not know how it happens exactly. They're very clear that there are a lot of neural circuits that are involved, because if you change those neural circuits, you know, through damaging them, let's say, in a stroke or a car accident or through some kind of an injury and so forth, or disease, well, then you'll actually change consciousness itself. On the other hand, more to your point, if a person gradually trains attention, which is the doorway into awareness, right? Attention is this marvelous gift because it fundamentally is under voluntary control. If you can gradually get control of your attention, you know, that spotlight and so forth, then you can gradually become increasingly aware both of what's happening around you. So you're picking up on signals at work or in important relationships that really matter, you know, rather than kind of missing them because you're so lost in thought or so distracted, et cetera. And even more fundamentally, you can become gradually more aware of yourself. Some practical ways to do that are to routinely, at least a minute or more a day, tune into your body, or if that's uncomfortable, and it is for some people, especially those who've had a history of, you know, seriously painful experiences, even traumatic ones, pick something else that's simple, like a candle, or, you know, the movement of leaves, or just looking at a tree, something that's calming and soothing and stable, or your breath, the sensations of your breath. And then for 1 minute, just stay with it. What you watch, of course, in the beginning is how that spotlight just jumps all over the place. But it's like building a muscle. The brain is, in a sense, like a muscle. If you practice, if you work at it in little, easy ways, you'll actually earn really, really good results.
I find what you're saying actually quite ironic because, you know, I remember as a kid, I used to be, and I don't know if in our social structures this would happen, but I used to be one of those kids that would daydream, and I'd go out, look out the window. And if I was in school daydreaming, I would always have a teacher, and I can remember this many times because my mind would wander off onto something that was not there. And what you're saying is that actually is positive. Now, I'm not saying that, oh, these teachers are going to let you happen, but I do remember many cases where the teacher would scold me and say, you know, Greg, get back here. Your mind is, you know, you're not focused on what you're supposed to be focused on.
I don't know quite how that – I don't – actually get that. In other words, if you're lost, I mean, there are a lot of things that are problematic about a conventional school system, but beyond that, you know, if a person is just sort of lost in thought, you know, their mind is wandering all over the place, I think there's occasionally benefit for that, you know, because it gives us a kind of stress relief. You know, it's a little mini vacation from long division in the fifth grade, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Totally natural. And it's also important to appreciate that there's neurological diversity. In other words, some kids and adults are, I think of them temperamentally like turtles, you know, one step at a time, very straightforward, and they're going to get there slow but sure, you know, kind of steady as she goes. Then you got at the other end, you got jackrabbits who dart all over the place, very creative, you know, lots of things popping into their head. And, you know, maybe you were a little bit more toward the jackrabbit end of the spectrum than the turtle.
I was.
There you go. And that's fine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's why I also in my book really try to think about how do you adapt these ancient methods, you know, that were developed thousands of years ago and work? They really work, but they were developed in settings very unlike our own, and to some extent people whose minds over time were different than our own because they were trained over time in a rural agrarian world. Mm-hmm. So I love developing methods in my book about how you can actually, for jackrabbits, in a jackrabbit culture, gradually steady the mind over time.
Well, I like the practical applications. Steady yourself on a candle, look at some leaves, do something to bring awareness. So now what are the next practical applications to tapping into this creative power that you talk about and steadying the mind?
Yeah, I would say some simple things that can really help a person, for example, be more mindful in daily life and also during those times they set aside, whatever it is, whether it's walking the dog or doing yoga or prayer or meditation or journaling or art or just sort of lying on the floor and trying to let the stress of the day drain out of the body and sinking down into Mother Earth. In any one of those things, there are a few good keys. One is to deliberately relax. We're so stressed, most of us. We're so driven, me included, that it really is important to activate what's called the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the calming, soothing, rest and digest wing of the nervous system that settles down the sympathetic nervous system, which is the stress response, fight or flight wing. All right. And so one great way to do parasympathetic activation is long exhalations, because the parasympathetic system handles exhaling. The sympathetic system handles inhaling. So if you make yourself take kind of a quick in-breath and then a long, slow exhalation 3 to 10 times, if your stress needle, on the 0 to 10 scale is pegging a 7, or if you're upset about something, rattled about something, bothered about something, at a 7, you just do 3 to 10 long exhalations. It's really hard to stop that needle from sinking back down to at least a 3 or a 4, maybe even down to a 1 or a 2. That's one. Another thing that I think is so important is to defeat the negativity bias of the brain, which is like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones, because it's the negative experiences our ancestors most needed to pay attention to, since they had the most impact for survival and passing on their genes. So one way to do that is when you're having a normal, typically a small or mild positive experience throughout the day, and there are many, many opportunities. There are dozens of opportunities for these every day. At least just do a handful of this. Take 30 seconds to savor the experience. Notice that it's okay. Notice that it feels pretty good. Notice that there's a good fact that legitimately could become a good experience. And then stay with it. Get those neurons firing together so they wire together. And so gradually you can transform your own brain. So it becomes increasingly like Velcro for positive experiences and Teflon for negative ones.
Well, no, so I was listening to the CDs, and you talk about that the brain generates suffering. That there's 6 fundamental properties that you were referencing there. What is it that's already got us pre-hardwired to actually generate suffering versus generating joy and happiness and bliss and positiveness in our life? So why is it already rewired to generate this suffering? And by the way, for my listeners, suffering is definitely an Eastern Buddhist concept, and that's the great thing about Rick and Richard Medinas. They're bringing in both the medical side and the Buddhist practices here. So can you explain it to our listeners?
Well, first, the word suffering is a loose translation of a Buddhist term. Another word that might be better for people would be stress or strain. In other words, most of the frustration, irritation, worry, exasperation, weariness, sense of being pressed, pushed by life, or a sense of unfulfillment or longing, dissatisfaction, disappointment, and so forth, most of that is on the 0 to 10 scale. Is hanging around a 1 or a 2 or 3. On the other hand, the truth is that most people would say that while, they're happy, things are good in some ways, definitely there are ways in which they can, for example, react negatively. They can get anxious or mad or feel inadequate or ashamed and so forth. That's the territory that I'm really focusing on here. And then if a person, for example, like you, and I think your listeners in general, are interested in not just not feeling horrible, but are interested in moving beyond that into really stable well-being that's increasingly unconditional. In other words, there's a quality of happiness and inner peace and calm and lovingness that's increasingly not rattled by the ups and downs of daily life, if they're interested in that. And even further, if they're interested in the upper reaches of human potential, including spiritual practice, then it gets very important to try to understand how this caveman, cavewoman brain, right, that's the product of 600 million years of an evolving nervous system, generally during very intense and harsh and lethal conditions. You know, how can we take charge of that caveman, cavewoman brain now in the 21st century, you know, which is unfortunately armed with nuclear weapons, right, and gradually incline our mind back to our fundamental kind of nature, which is caring, contented, and calm. So to me, that's how to do it. And one way to start is to appreciate what makes us suffer. And a key idea here is, I think, given in the Buddhist metaphor of the two darts. In other words, it's the idea that in life there's an inevitable amount of discomfort, physical and emotional and interpersonal, right? You can't get out of this life without facing old age, disease, and death, without facing loss, without facing, you know, ups and downs in your relationships and so forth, right? But then what happens is we react to those inevitable discomforts with all the second darts that we throw ourselves. So what you can gradually do over time, and in my book I laid out a lot of practical ways to do it, and then in the meditations, CDs, you know, very practical ways to do kind of practices that really help you to do this and change your brain over time, is that what you can do is you can start watching the reactions, and you can start getting ahead of the parade increasingly, so that increasingly if those first darts land, or events in general that aren't even a dart, they're just like someone paid you a compliment, right? It's no dart at all, but then the mind starts going, if they only knew, right? What can happen then is that you can put in a kind of shock absorber so that even though the first dart has landed, something's tough, you're stuck in traffic, you're dealing with a sibling quarrel, you know, your boss or coworkers not treating you real well right there, something's coming up in your childhood, you know, you're looking for love, whatever it is, when that first dart arises, you put in that shock absorber, and so you don't react to it so much. And then gradually over time, you know, you build the neural circuits that I think of it like a keel in the water of a sailboat. You know, you build out neural circuits over time that make you increasingly centered, even though, you know, life's got its ups and downs.
I think it's great advice, too, because as someone elevates consciousness through these practices and moves to new levels and heightened levels of awareness and reduction of the suffering, those people they're around, whether it's a spouse or somebody at work, if they can utilize that, they can utilize it positively to not set them off. Because they actually are rewiring these neural circuits, as you're talking about. And one of the things that you speak about is that meditation does the most to change the brain patterns. And you talk about three key areas that are affected by meditation, parts of the brain. Can you explain to our listeners, you know, why a practice of meditation, whether it's 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes in the evening or a half an hour in the morning, doesn't matter when, but just taking that time out for themselves to reconnect and make a connection, which is with something that's higher than them, and to actually kind of clear that brain.
Yeah. Well, meditation's definitely been the most studied intervention in the it's been the most studied mental activity in terms of its impact on the brain, which I think is fantastic. I would also say that I think my own opinion, and I think it's supported in general ways by research, is probably the most powerful way to change your own brain over time is to focus on small positive experiences half a dozen or more times a day and then really savor them. Because what you want to do is you want to take in resources, right? On a regular basis, you want to take in resources. Now, meditation is a great way to both take in resources when you're sitting, and it trains that spotlight. You know, it's a critical tool in terms of helping a person get more control over the spotlight of attention, that vacuum cleaner. So, specifically, in terms of impact on the brain itself, I'll just call out two main regions in particular. Much research has shown that if you have any kind of regular meditative practice or a prayerful one, there are many kinds of contemplative activity, right? Including, for example, doing it while doing a physical activity like yoga and so forth. if you do that, number one, you actually thicken layers of the brain. You actually build neural structure in a part of the brain called the cingulate cortex, which is involved in controlling attention. In other words, no surprise, if you practice controlling your attention, you build up the muscle, right? You build up the neural circuitry that helps enable you to control your attention better, you know, in the future. The second part of the brain that gets measurably built up is called the insula. It's a part of the brain that does that tunes into the body, that helps you really know what you're feeling, both in your body sensations, but also in your deep emotions. And then as a bonus, which is really great, is that as you do some kind of a practice of self-awareness that thickens the insula, people actually become more empathic for the emotions of others. In other words, as you tune more into yourself, it's fantastic. You actually become better able to tune into other people. And then as you just said a moment ago, then normally, naturally, they feel more like you're listening to them. They feel more felt by you, in a sense. And then as a result, you often, not guaranteed, but often, positive cycles will happen in which they'll start treating you better as well. So I just think that if there's, you know, one thing I was, a long time ago, you know, 100 years ago, the father of psychology in America, William James, said the education of attention would be an education par excellence. And there's nothing that's a better education of attention than meditation.
Oh, most definitely. And I think that, you know, these tools that you provide within this meditation to change the brain are so valuable to our listeners, and it's so important. Now, Rick, can you tell our listeners, you know, I can see your website and your event page is really loaded. I mean, if you look at, I'm going to tell my listeners, Rick's going to be in many different locations, including upcoming in Europe and London and Belgium, Germany. But he's got some upcoming workshops that are going to be at the Greater Good Science Center in Berkeley on the 22nd. He's got another one at Spirit Rock on the 23rd. And then he's got And then he's got the Buddha's Brain Seminar at the Crown Plaza in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania on the 25th. And another one in Crown Plaza, Cherry Hill.
I'm feeling tired already.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. How are you even going to make all that stuff? You better get your brain in gear. So, Rick, tell our listeners where they can go to get grounded in this, in the material that you have, get your book. I don't know if you've got – I know you've got CDs out. I don't know if there's some stuff on YouTube you may want to direct them to so they can get a better idea of your teachings, philosophy,
sure,
and the way and the direction in which you take this.
Well, it's very kind of you to say that, Greg. And how I look at it is that, you know, I think lots and lots of good things are happening in the world, really. You know, they don't make the news because, as they say in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads, right? But on the other hand, we've got some challenges here. And I think the more that people can get control of their brains, you know, that caveman, cavewoman brain, the better they're going to feel themselves. You know, and it is something they can actually do at a time when so many of us feel pushed around by big, powerful forces that we have no control over, you know, like the economy, global warming, Al-Qaeda, politics, Fox News, whatever, right? The other thing, so basically on my website, just go to buddhasbrain.com. There are tons of free resources that are offered there that really come out of the tradition of both science and Buddhism that offers what it finds freely. The second thing is that my book itself, Buddha's Brain, you know, it's $12.21 on Amazon. It's a good buy, and it's been very, 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 very well reviewed. It's very practical. I wrote it for regular people in the middle of real life, while simultaneously grounding it in super hard, real science, many references, as well as informed and illuminated by the world's great contemplative traditions. Additionally, I do have a number of offerings through Sounds True. They, too, are very affordable, and some of them are coming out in addition to the one that we've been talking about today. And so those are a lot of resources for people, too. It's also true that those of your listeners who happen to be therapists, I'm doing a lot of teaching these days for therapists because, or mental health professionals or healthcare professionals in general, because a lot of these methods, what's fantastic about them is that you can always use them for yourself, you know, and in your own family and those immediately around you. But they're also great if you work with other people. And who doesn't work with other people? You know, whether it's in a helping framework, you know, like in a hospital or a clinical setting or a therapist setting, et cetera. But even beyond that, gosh, these kind of approach methods are fantastic for prospects if you're in sales or customer service or working things out with people, you know, next to you in the cubicle at work. So, you know, the thing that excites me fundamentally is that we live at a time where it's with absolutely unprecedented knowledge from science. In other words, brain science has doubled in the last 20 years. Just 20 years, it's doubled in the amount of information it holds. It's widely estimated. So we live in a time where we're actually learning increasingly how to use the mind to change the brain, to change the mind for the better. The mind alone, not drugs, not psychosurgery, nothing. How to use the mind alone change the brain to change the mind for the better. And when you can do that, in a certain sense, you've got the keys to the kingdom, at least the kingdom that's inside your own skull.
Well, Rick, it's an honor having you back on again. I want to let our listeners know, too, that Rick has two other books called Measuring the Immeasurable and Mother Nature. Those will be listed up at our site. Measuring the Unmeasurable, The Scientific Case for Spirituality. And I guess your first book is Mother Nature.
Nurture.
Mother Nurture. Sorry, Mother Nurture. So please look on our website for links to these books as well as to the Sounds True Meditations to Change Your Brain, which is what we've been speaking about this morning. Rick, it's always a pleasure having you on. I hope that your body and mind and spirit can handle all of the travel that's about ready to come up for you.
Well, thank you. But, it's a privilege that people want to listen to me. So I'm very grateful that anyone is sitting in the room.
Well, we appreciate having you on, and it's always a pleasure, and I know we'll get you back on again for another Sounds True or one of the other books. So thanks so much for your time.